My name is John Halpin. I'm a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Let me first thank Congressman Meek again for his very thoughtful and encouraging remarks. We're glad to be working directly with him on this concept and ways to implement it. It's an honor and a privilege for me to be back at my alma mater. I graduated from the college in 1993, studied government, philosophy, and sociology. Georgetown University was really transformative for me personally. Just a little bit of background. I grew up in a Catholic family in Lynchburg, Virginia, which made me somewhat of an outlier in a town filled with very traditionalist and conservative Protestants. For those of you who don't know, Lynchburg is the home base of Jerry Falwell, the founding pastor of the Thomas Road Baptist Church, and the man who astutely blamed 9/11 on feminist gays, the ACLU, and People for the American Way. Despite the occasional intemperate outburst from a right-wing leader, Lynchburg is actually a very decent town with a lot of well-intentioned, honest, and generous people. Growing up there, I actually learned an enormous amount about how one should act and live in accordance with the principles of the common good. Lynchburg is not, however, the kind of town where you can sit in on a parlor discussion about the Pullman strike or the social gospel movement. It's much more of a town, sort of a left-behind book club town. Two things changed all of that for me. One, the Jesuits and other professors here at Georgetown exposed me to all sorts of forward-looking thinking from Western history. And two, Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992. Now, in hindsight, the convergence of these two opportunities while I was an undergrad mattered tremendously to my own personal development and my own thinking about the common good, and I'll forever be grateful and think fondly of Georgetown for those opportunities. I'm just going to briefly give you a two-minute version of a couple thousand years of thinking about the common good so we can move into our discussion. Unlike a long-standing philosophical principle like liberalism, which has very clear values around human autonomy, rationality, self-government, individual liberty, there isn't a uniform understanding of this principle of the common good. Aristotle, Aquinas, James Madison, Rousseau, others have all written about it, but they all talked about it in different ways. But when I think about the common good, there are four distinct sources that I think can give some coherence to this philosophy. One, it's not an accident we're here, is Catholic social teaching and the teaching of other major faiths, with a focus on solidarity, human dignity, service to others, and other principles. The second major source, of course, is the liberalism of the founding, primarily the writings of Jefferson and Madison, the focus on human freedom and rights, constitutional democracy, a notion of balancing self-interest and factions through effective government. A third source that we draw upon is communitarian thinking, frequently associated with Tocqueville, Michael Sandel, Etzioni, and others. This focus on strong social bonds, families, communities, civil society. And a final source that I think is important is the original sort of spirit of the progressive era, the kind of trust-busting actions of Teddy Roosevelt and the notion of balancing excessive corporate power with a strong national government that was found in Herbert Croly and others. Now, while all of these various sources have distinct ideas that are sometimes in conflict with one another, they all talk about this moral and civic principle of the common good. Now, moving below just the phrase, the common good, there are some subsidiary principles that really matter, I think, in terms of context. When I think about this term and look through the historical development of it, there are a number of things that matter. One, you're trying to achieve social and economic conditions that benefit all. You're trying to put public needs and concerns above the interests of the few, trying to promote an ethic of responsibility and service to others. You're trying to treat people as citizens and not just consumers. You're trying to do more to aid the poor and the disadvantaged and take care of our natural resources. And you're trying to pursue just and cooperative global actions. Now, in trying to achieve all of these goals, it's not just government that does this, but government plays an important role. Families and communities and faith institutions play a vital role. Markets play an important role, and government has a very strong role as well. This is in distinction to our conservative brethren who believe that individuals and markets will essentially take care of our public needs. In terms of policy, I'll just briefly give you an overview of what we've been focusing on at CAP. We focus on three big, applying this concept to, in a policy setting. On economics, we talk about universal programs on health, education, retirement security, new ways to help people save and build wealth, tax fairness, helping people reduce consumer debt, and other new ways, innovative ways, to increase American competitiveness. On the social and personal front, We're starting to develop some policies around enhancing and expanding models of national service in both the military and civilian setting, and also ways to sort of attack this culture of greed and materialism in American life, and particularly the pernicious commercial targeting of children. On the international front, as John mentioned, we're trying to restore America's time-honored tradition of using all of its powers, military, economic, diplomatic, to adequately secure the nation and tackle some of the biggest problems in the world, including poverty and global climate change. So this is just, again, kind of the two-minute version of a lot of thinking that's gone on in history and what will be a forward-looking program for us in terms of policy. And this is just one perspective on what is vastly, quickly becoming a very rich dialogue within progressive circles about the common good. And to that, I now want to turn to a very esteemed panel here. I'm going to give some brief introductions of each so we can move into actual discussion. I do encourage you all to look at the very nice glossy bios. They explain all of the wonderful professional accomplishments of the folks we have on the stage. So I do encourage you to take a look at that. And I'm going to start on the left here and go forward. E.J. Dion is our moderator today. I'm sure almost everyone here knows E.J. From his perch with the twice weekly syndicated column at the Washington Post. He's one of America's foremost political journalists and thinkers. He's written a number of books that have been quite influential in my own thinking. And of course, he's also a professor in the Public Policy Institute here at Georgetown. And is also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and we're very pleased to have EJ moderate this discussion today. Next, we have Anna Berger, who is the Secretary-Treasurer of the Service Employees International Union, 1.8 million member organization that is the largest healthcare union, the largest building security union, I think this, second largest public employees union. And Gannett has talked about Anna as one of the most influential women in U.S. labor after her election as chair of the Change to Win Coalition, a new coalition of labor unions representing about 6 million members. We have Professor Neil Katyal, who will be familiar to many of the Georgetown community here. He's a professor of law in the Law Center and was most recently the lead counsel in the Hamdan v. Rumsfeld case, the carefully watched and ultimately successful case that challenged the constitutionality of the military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay. We have the Honorable Tom Perez, who is a council member with Montgomery County. He was president of the council for a while. He's also a professor of law at the University of Maryland. And I'm a resident of Maryland now, and he was a very strong candidate for Attorney General before the Maryland Court of Appeals stepped in and mucked it up. Hopefully that will change over time. Next, we have the Reverend Jennifer Butler, who is the Executive Director of Faith and Public Life, a new organization started by national religious leaders to help organize and better promote the ideas of the burgeoning social justice faith movement. Jennifer is an ordained Presbyterian minister and was the Presbyterian Church's representative to the United Nations. Next, we have Bruce Reed, who is the president of the Democratic Leadership Council. As John mentioned, played a very intimate and direct role in a lot of the themes and policies of President Clinton's presidency. He was the domestic policy advisor for the president and drafted the 1996 Welfare Reform Act, among other major legislative accomplishments. Next, we have a good colleague of mine and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, Gail Smith. Gail focuses on international relations and national security. She was the director of African Affairs in the National Security Council during President Clinton's term and spent 20 years in Africa as a journalist, focusing on military and economic issues in Africa. And finally, we have another esteemed member of the Georgetown community, Professor Michael Kazin, who's a professor of history here. He's one of the nation's leading scholars on the political history of the 19th and 20th centuries. He's most recent author of A Godly Hero, The Life of William Jennings Bryan, and I believe he's working on a book about the American left now. So I'm really looking forward to the discussion, and I thank all of you for coming, and I'm going to turn it over to EJ now. Thanks.
Thank you very much. John really did deserve that applause. 2,000 years in 2 minutes. It means he'd either make a great professor or a brilliant high-toned spin doctor. That was really, really well done. And I also, in this election season, I also love to think about the ways in which people's words would be distorted. I understood him to use the words very astute about Jerry Falwell. So it would be liberal praises Falwell at progressive conference. So thank you very, very much. I always feel very good when I'm in this room because 15 years ago, as it happens, just like Congressman Meek, I got married at the Dahlgren Chapel next door to my wife, Mary Boyle, a Georgetown grad. She didn't see much of her graduation because she was right behind Patrick Ewing in line. That's true. But she's a big basketball player, so she was happy about that. And I think it's very appropriate that this is at Georgetown because I don't think there is a place where the idea of the common good is more important. And I would say that that's true not only of progressive professors, but a lot of conservative professors, people, conservatives I admire, like Professor George Carey. I hope I don't ruin his reputation by praising him here today. And I think it's natural because of the Catholic and Jesuit tradition. And in keeping with that, I've decided that the rules of our panel were laid down by Bernard Lonergan, the great theologian, who had four transcendental concepts, as he called them: be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. Reverend Meek talked about random acts of kindness. Today we're going to see random acts of great intelligence. And if you are surprised by the size of the panel, so were all of us, and we decided this is not a panel, but a small academic or political convention. And everyone on the panel is aware of their obligations under those circumstances. Some old friends in the audience know that I am very fond of an Al Smith story, where Al Smith was heckled one day in a big crowd. The heckler yelled, "Tell him all you know, Al. It won't take long." And Al Smith shot back, "I'll tell him all we both know, and it won't take longer." We got to go back to the heckling tradition in our politics. So I will take 1 minute myself before I go to this panel that has so much more to say than I do. I was glad John referred to Mike Sandel, who's one of my favorite thinkers. And one of Mike's great lines is, "If politics goes well, we can know a good in common that we cannot know alone." And I think that's a very powerful idea, and it shows, I think, that the idea of the common good is not just some empty concept, because the key there is that we cannot know alone, that there is something in collective and community action that actually changes society and changes the nature of our transactions. It means that politics is important, because if politics does not go well, the rules under which citizens live will be perceived as unjust. They'll be distant from the values the society claims to espouse, and citizens come to doubt the legitimacy of their system. I think there's no escaping politics, because there's no escaping the fact that the rules established in workplace and government, in the marketplace and neighborhoods, will powerfully influence what all of us does, even the most individualistic souls among us. Some rules make it easier for families to raise their kids, others make it more difficult. Some make it easier for individuals to seize opportunities, some make it more difficult. Some encourage charity, generosity, community-mindedness, others discourage them. Getting those rules right cannot occur unless all of us commit ourselves to achieving a comprehensive understanding of the common good, and that's what we are going to do today. And so I want to start off by asking a basic question. The common good idea has been floating around for 2,000 years, but it's also gained new currency recently. A friend of many of ours, Mike Tomasky, wrote a very powerful piece on this in the American Prospect. And so the question I want to ask, and I'm going to ask Reverend Jen, this is a religious university, so I want to start with Reverend Jen, as she told me I could call her. Why should progressives focus on this concept at all? Is it a better organizing principle than freedom or justice? Does it provide a helpful contrast with what passes these days for a conservative philosophy? And I want to make it harder by saying an unacceptable answer is, well, of course it embodies freedom and justice, because we know that. So we'll accept that, and then I want you to take it from there.
Right. Thanks for making it more challenging.
I am a professor here, you know.
That's right. I think we have an unprecedented opportunity right now in the progressive community to reclaim the values debate. The polling numbers show that the God gap that opened in 2004 is closing, and people are very frustrated with the cynical use of religion by the current administration. You have Kuo's book just out on faith-based initiatives that adds fuel to the fire. But the common good is a way that we can retake this debate and really insert ourselves in a very insightful and genuine way. It's a concept that's been around for many, many years. It's one that resonates deeply in faith communities. It's at the core of Catholic social teaching. It also resonates deeply with evangelicals, in fact, who are very, very interested in Catholic teaching and are hearkening to the many, many centuries of Catholic thought that has been built up on these issues. What we find in faith communities is actually that this term is being used quite a bit in the past couple of years, and that there's not only a resurgence among progressive faith communities weighing in on public debates, but also that they're choosing to use this term very explicitly. You have Protestants for the Common Good, Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good. You have faith leaders out in Colorado opposing Tabor on the basis of common good and using that language very much.
Tabor is a tax limitation.
Tax limitation, a sort of gutting of government. It seems to be bubbling up as well from the grassroots, and it's a very powerful unifying concept. And I think specifically what's unique about it, as opposed to, say, freedom or justice, is it really emphasizes community over our sort of rampant individualism. And we've been paying close attention to recent polls on faith and politics and values. And we find that what Americans are saying is that the most urgent moral problem in America is greed and materialism, corruption in government, jobs in the economy, the war in Iraq, and those are issues that can be really spoken to finally through using the concept of the common good.
Thank you. Professor Katyal, I'd like you to address this. And in particular, there are very few people who've done more work on behalf of individual rights. Do you worry that the common good concept might erode a sort of civil liberties, a devotion to civil liberties, or would it strengthen it?
Oh, I think it would definitely strengthen it. That is, the concept of individual rights is, I think, amorphous, and it invites backlash. It invites people talking about, at least in the work that I've been doing, coddling terrorists with special rights and the like. Common good is a broader concept. And let me, just for a moment, and I realize I'm the opening band here, so I'll be quiet after a minute, but the Hamdan case is about the most central question a democracy faces, which is, can the president set up a system to try people on his own? These trials at Guantanamo Bay were taking place where the president, by executive fiat, appointed the prosecutors, wrote all the trial rules, hand-picked the judges, hand-defined all of the offenses, and then said the federal courts have no role in this. Now, the Supreme Court, when they last confronted something like this, although it was much better, in 1866, said, this is the central question about rights in a democracy. Now, when I was litigating the Hamdan case, I could have used the language of rights, but instead I used something that I think is much closer to the common good. And the reason is, when you talk about individual rights, it doesn't bring in all of the values that you want to bring in. In particular, for this case, the values of the military, the Geneva Conventions, the idea that our troops get hurt if you allow the executive the ability to suspend the most sacred protections of the laws of war. And that's why, I certainly got some hate mail from people as I did this case saying you're special rights for terrorists, but I got tons of letters from troops saying, you're protecting me by standing up for the Geneva Conventions, because if I'm caught somewhere, I don't want some despot or dictator to say, I'm the executive, I get to say the Geneva Conventions don't apply. And that's the way we framed the case, as about our military. And that is, sad to say, the way this administration has really squandered the respect of troops. I mean, they talk about being tough on defense, but that's really tough on weapon systems and things like that. When you're talking about the common good, protecting the troops, I think the progressives have outlined a much better vision for that. And so it was not surprising to me that the case was won in part on the idea that the Geneva Conventions were essentially trampled on by President Bush. And who wrote all the opinions? Oh, every single time Mr. Hamdan won, either the district court or the Supreme Court, the opinion was written by by someone who had served in the military, Justice Stevens, Justice Kennedy, and Judge Robertson on the district court. So I think common good encapsulates something much broader than the rhetoric of rights, which I think invokes a kind of backlash and special privileges discourse that we really don't want to have.
Thank you. Bruce Reed, some people meditate, you know, thinking of the word om. Bruce meditates thinking of opportunity, responsibility, community, which were key words in President Clinton's speeches in this room. While I was getting married next door, Bruce was writing the speeches for Clinton. I'd love you to reflect on where this concept has gone. Also, I think Professor Katyal's intervention was very helpful, but could you talk about room in your life?
Sure, thank you, EJ. I guess I'm the designated has-been on this panel. It was actually 15 years ago yesterday that I wrote the first draft of the first New Covenant speech, sitting in a hotel room in suburban Pittsburgh, waiting for the Atlanta Braves to defeat my Pittsburgh Pirates in Game 7. Tom Glavine, for those of you who are Mets fans, Tom Glavine lost Game 5 of that series. Braves came back and won, so don't be too discouraged. Barry Bonds weighed 70 pounds less than he does now. it is worth telling the story of Clinton's Georgetown speeches because I think it speaks to why we're here and what we're searching for, why we're trying to define a philosophy. Clinton came to Georgetown to do what too few Democratic candidates had done before that time and what too few have done since, which was to lay out his philosophy, say what he stood for, and try to explain exactly what he would do for the country consistent with that philosophy. 3 weeks earlier, he had announced his candidacy in Little Rock by saying that Americans don't just need to hear Bush bashing. They deserve a president who will tell them exactly what he'll do to make their lives better. And the philosophy that he laid out here in the speeches at Georgetown was one that he had studied here at Georgetown. He quoted one of his professors, Carol Quigley, he talked about this singular importance of linking opportunity and responsibility, that's what made a community, that the basic bargain of America is that everyone in America ought to have the opportunity to get ahead, and every American has a responsibility to make the most of it. And that was that's not a new philosophy. It's the essence of the American dream, but it is one that the political world had lost sight of in the decades before that. And I think you can make a pretty good argument that it's forgotten. The political world has forgotten that again. So he came to Georgetown, spoke to a group of students just like this. It was such a long time ago that when the speech was over, the students actually got to ask questions. The press stood quietly in the back of the room, didn't say anything snarky. In the first speech was the first time that he'd ever proposed ending welfare as we know it. But the particulars are less important than the politics that they embodied. One of the reasons that I think our politics has gone wrong over the last 6 years is that we've gotten out of the business of solving people's problems at a time when people needed them most, and we've been sorely handicapped by having a president who has been unable to articulate what we're about and what our common purpose is at a time when we were hungrier for it than ever before. So as we look forward to turning the page on this era, I think it's absolutely essential that everybody on both sides of the aisle, frankly, come to terms with this basic question, and whether you call it the common good or the national interest or the new covenant or the American dream, the basic point is what Teddy Roosevelt said, that our common interests are as broad as the continent, what Franklin Roosevelt said, that together we must all shoulder the common load, and that what Bill Clinton said here 15 years ago, which is there's a hole in our politics where a sense of common purpose used to be.
Thank you. Anna Berger, by the way, just so you know, I'm doing exactly what I said I wouldn't do before this panel started, which is going down the line. But I think it's probably a good idea to get everyone in. And then I want people free to either interrupt each other or jump on other comments. But let me turn to Anna, because I think there's a really interesting paradox in the trade union movement where, on the one hand, it often asserts that there are adversarial interests between employers and employees, and yet in doing so, it seeks to achieve the common good by achieving a fairer distribution of rewards, and I think the movement would argue thus more efficiency in the economy. Could you talk about what would a concept like this mean to your members, and how do you sort of look at the idea of a common good?
Well, if you think about it, the reality is our labor movement is, you know, is centered around the common good. I grew up in Pennsylvania in the 1950s, so I'll date myself a little bit. But when one in three workers was in a union, and unions lifted up whole families, whole communities, whole industries, whole generations, it meant a kid like me growing up with a mom who worked in a nursing home, and a dad who was a truck driver who was disabled from when I was nine, could raise five kids and have us go to college and have me graduate without being buried in debt. It was a different time. Now one in 12 workers is in a union. The voices of workers has been quieted and quieted, and as weaker and weaker, and as a result of it, we aren't able to raise up whole communities. While the wage differential for unionized workers and unorganized workers is very different, unionized workers are paid more, they're more likely to have health care, more likely to have retirement. The number of them is smaller, and as a result, we haven't been able to have the influence in raising up everybody. We believe as a movement that we need to do that. We just did a survey of working families in our country to find out what they really thought, because some people said, oh, the American dream is no longer relevant. Well, the reality is the American dream is very relevant, very alive. Only 3% of the people that we surveyed didn't believe in the American dream. And only 3% believed that it was about personal wealth. Everyone else believed strongly. They knew what it was. A job that you could support a family and be proud of. Health care for yourself and your family and for all Americans. A retirement that you could count on, and the ability to give your children a better life than you had. The American legacy. Now, the scary thing, and that united people across red state, blue state, white, black, brown, native-born, immigrant, male, female, you name it. It was uniting. They were also totally united about the fact that they were fearful that they were not going to achieve the American dream. Only 14% believed that they had achieved it. Majority believed that they were at risk of not achieving it. And the scary thing for me was 80% believed that their kids would not have a better life than they did. Over 50% believed that their kids would have a worse life than they did. Over 50% of college graduated workers believed that their kids would have a worse life. They believed that it is at risk. The good news also, though, was that they also were united about the solutions, that if they joined an organization or a union in their industry, that they personally would have a better life, again, across all lines. They also believed that if they got involved in politics and made their voices heard, that they could have a difference and that they could make a difference. And they also believed that government had to play a role, that government needed to be on their side about health care, about retirement security, about creating good jobs, and they were hungry for elected officials to speak out about this agenda that raised up everybody, not just the few. People are tired of a winner-take-all society. They want to win all together. And I believe that the message of the common good resonates. And I believe that as elected officials, you know, if we really wanted to do something in our society, we should restore workers' rights to have a union. They want to have a union. If we had decent laws that protected their rights to have a free choice to have a union, we would again be able to create a society that lifted everyone up.
I'm going to cheat here and ask you if now or later is the time to recite your favorite statistics that you showed me before.
Well, so some people say to me that the marketplace is the solution. Well, guess what, folks? It just isn't true. If you look at the last 25 years, there are four numbers that kind of say it all in my mind. The stock market went up 793%. CEO salaries up 743%. Worker productivity up 68%. And wages, stagnant zero. Workers are now working longer hours for less money than at any time in the last 25 years. The marketplace does not work. We need an active government on the side of working people. We need an active workers' movement, an active workers' voice, again, in our society, if we're really going to be able to address the issues of the common good.
Thank you. Tom Perry, as you have gotten, I think this is a true fact, more votes than anyone else on this panel. You've had to make arguments in political campaigns. Mm-hmm. How does this concept strike you, both as somebody who ran for public office and as somebody who served in public office, as a unifying concept to guide people in what they do. So not it's not just a slogan, you know, to manipulate voters, but rather an idea that actually, you know, does it say something useful to a public official?
I think it's been a very useful concept, and you, Reverend Jen, pointed out before, after the 2004 election, there was a poll done, and what are the largest, what are the biggest moral issues confronting America? The two things right at the top of the list, this was right after Ohio and the quote-unquote values voters, poverty and greed and materialism. And so what I have talked about in my service as a local elected official is that we are indeed all in this together. It's not about simply I, but it's about we. And I talk about local government as really working to build the four, what I call, building blocks of self-sufficiency: education, housing, healthcare, and good jobs. And if we can invest in those four pillars of self-sufficiency at a local government level, we can build community. And we all have a shared interest in making sure that the rising tide does indeed lift all boats, because it's a matter of economic competitiveness. And so I talk about this a lot. When I was council president, I talked about the fact that budgets are indeed moral documents. They reflect the moral values of a community. And when you look at our budget, we have a $4 billion budget in Montgomery County. Half of it goes to the Montgomery County public school system. And so it reflects our belief that we are investing in education, which is the fundamental building block. We invested $10 million in healthcare for the uninsured because of the utter abdication of responsibility at a state and federal level, and so we had to invest in a local level. We have 29% of the affordable units generated through inclusionary zoning nationwide have been generated through an inclusionary zoning program in our county. And so I really believe when you talk about these concepts, and we passed a living wage bill 5 years ago. And so I think these concepts have real resonance because people do recognize that it's not simply the I, me society, it's the we, and we embody that renewed sense of shared responsibility in the budget actions that we take.
Gail, I wanted to ask you, I wanted to go back to the original question about the common good versus other ideas, particularly freedom. There was a very good session at the Center for American Progress some months ago with Professor John Schwartz, who was talking about reclaiming the idea of freedom as a central purpose of liberals or progressives. And, you know, in some sense, I want to ask, why is this idea better than freedom? And I'd love for you to relate it to some of the work you're doing on, you know, on security and, you know, national and domestic security.
Well, I think, I mean, if you think about it, we're at a point now where our entire debate about how we engage with the world is subscribed by the war on terror. Freedom is a word put out there frequently. It's delivered on less frequently if you look at our practical actions. We've done a great job at proving that we're able to be tough on national security, and also, and importantly, that we're willing to take the facts into account and be smart on national security. The common good gives us the opportunity, though, to say we may be in a war against terror, but we're also in a struggle for something. And I think that something is bigger than just freedom, which is important, but it's an intangible. I think what the common good means is marrying up the notion of national security, of protecting and defending America, with the concept of human dignity and human security, which again is bigger than just freedom because it includes fundamentally freedom from want. I was in Africa about a year ago, and I made a point of asking everybody I talked to how they saw America today. And these were business people, academics, policymakers, people inside and outside of government, many of them with dual passports from Africa, from Asia, and from the Middle East. All of them said that the ideal of America had been lost, that America used to be the champion of all of us, and now America is the champion only of itself. And their conclusion was that China should hurry up and attain superpower status because we needed to have another superpower to hold us in check. Now, I think if we can embrace the notion of human security and human dignity in tandem with national security, we can align our interests with those of other people. The things that we care about, education, healthcare, decent work, a safe environment for our children, affordable oil, all of those things are the things that others care about. So if we put ourselves in the forefront of leading for the common good, I think we're offering people more than political freedom or even the promise of political freedom. We're offering them tangible change. I think there's one qualification there, though. We've got to be prepared to invest in the common good abroad if we want to receive the returns of it. We can't do it on the cheap. It's one of the problems we've got now. Again, freedom from tyranny is a phrase used in every speech that George Bush gives. Who remains the strongest patron of Saudi Arabia? The United States. There's been no movement on that, and that's the kind of thing that people watch. So I think the difference is it puts at the core human dignity and freedom from want. It implies a common interest, and therefore is a unifying principle. And it gives us a platform from which to lead if, in fact, we deliver on it.
Thank you. The Reverend William Jennings Cazin. As you all know, Mike has written a very, very important book on William Jennings Bryan, and in some sense has done a great job of historical rescue of a reputation that deserved to be rescued. And I'd love you, Mike, to talk about this common good idea, whether explicitly or implicitly, historically, in both the populist movement, which you've written about, and later progressive movements. How much did this idea actually animate those movements which we now look back upon as progressive, including, thanks to you, William Jennings Bryan?
A great deal, but if you wouldn't mind, sort of change the question a little bit and open up a problem.
That means he'd make a good politician. He'd never answer the question as asked.
Because, my role as the designated historian in some ways is to complicate things, I think, and ask questions as well as to celebrate the possibilities. And I think that, there are two powerful progressive languages, I think, in the 20th century, especially. One is the language of the common good, which people like Teddy Roosevelt spoke to, Franklin Roosevelt spoke to, Martin Luther King Jr. Spoke to. But the other language, which is equally powerful, especially since the 1960s, is the language of rights, the rights discourse. In many ways, these languages sometimes clash. And people who, a friend of mine, a friend of EJ's, Todd Gitlin, wrote a wonderful book a few years ago called The Twilight of Common Dreams, in which he criticized his own side, the progressive side, for talking about group rights, individual rights, and not talking about a different future, a different vision for the whole society. But I think the rights discourse accomplished some wonderful things. Ironically, of course, it emerged from the Black Freedom Movement, which was a very communitarian movement based in the Black church. But it took off. It's won wonderful gains for gay men and lesbians, for women generally, for Black people, Latinos, Asian Americans, disabled people, and so forth. We know all that. The question, I think, is how one includes, integrates that language and those aspirations, that vision of the free individual within a larger vision of a freer, more communitarian society. And these tensions have always been there. They were there for Bryan, who talked about the community as a whole, winning back its rights from the big corporations, and he supported labor unions, he supported farmers organizing, supported an income tax as a moral responsibility, not so much to get revenue for the government. But at the same time, he was a great supporter of prohibition, which he thought was a reform which would help the common good. It would do away with these terrible saloons and the corruption saloon dealers responsible for in city government and state government. And of course, that people who believed in their personal liberty to have a drink were unhappy with that side of Bryan. And I won't even mention the Scopes trial. So I think that as we go forward in talking about this vision and trying to understand how it can be an alternative to the conservative vision, which is more and more a conservative delusion rather than conservative vision, I think we have to deal with our recent past and our more distant past, in which these two languages of change in many ways can be integrated, but also the integration of them is not an easy task.
I want to thank you. There's an old Bob Dylan line, no use in talking to me, same as talking to you. And I will confirm that what I've written at the bottom of the page here is the twilight of common dreams. And I think that's exactly where I wanted us to go, because I think you, by the way, Roosevelt and repeal was the best slogan in American history. I wanted to go precisely to that issue of multiculturalism, identity politics, rights-based politics of the 60s. When Mike Tomasky's piece appeared in the American Prospect, David Brooks wrote an interesting column in the New York Times saying that the resurgence of the common good signaled the decline of multiculturalism and identity politics. Anybody on the panel who wants to take this on, to what extent is that true? How does traditional rights-based liberalism fit into a conception of a common good? Is it contradictory to it? Is it enrich it? How does somebody want to take that on? Because I do think that is at the heart of one of the important debates about the common good.
I disagree. Our governor, Bob Ehrlich, recently said two things about multiculturalism. He said, multiculturalism is bunk. It's crap. Those were his words, not my words.
That's an academic
word.
That's
a term of art, EJ, I believe. I looked up crap and bunk in the dictionary. I think the common good is... It's not monolithic. When we talk about producing the common good, we're not simply talking about everybody melding into one. We're talking about inclusion and fundamental respect and embracing our diversity. And so I think Governor Ehrlich misses the mark when he talks about multiculturalism as being a framework for the balkanization of the races and ethnicities. 100 years ago in the state of Maryland, we had German immersion programs for our new German immigrants, and he now criticizes Spanish immersion 100 years later. I believe the common good and the civil rights movement can be, although I recognize the tension that you've outlined, can be completely complementary, because the civil rights movement is indeed about recognizing that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And so we need to come together in the common good. It's about respecting that people come from different countries, different ethnicities, different sexual orientations, and that we can come together around some common principles. So I categorically reject the notion that multiculturalism and the common good are somehow mutually exclusive.
But Anna wanted to jump in, and let me try to complicate it, because I think in principle everybody on the panel is going to say that civil rights and guaranteeing, you know, the rights of minorities is a part of the common good. But I do think there's a philosophical difference between, and Gitlin ran into a lot of trouble on this from some of his friends on the left in The Twilight of Common Dreams, between ideas rooted in universalism versus ideas rooted in individual rights. And the paradox, I think, is that the individual and group right, the rights of discriminated against groups ultimately rest on a series of universal concepts, or those rights can't be vindicated. Could you?
I would just say that I think that the common good actually goes right up against and at head-on the politics of division. I think that people are tired of the politics of dividing people, that somehow you need to push someone else down to be able to hold on to whatever you have, whether it's over the immigration battles or gay battles or whatever the battles are that try to divide people. I think that the idea of talking about the common good and bringing everybody up actually takes that right on. And I do think that as we talk about what we mean by the common good, where we talk about giving opportunity and responsibility together, I think it speaks directly to all parts of our society, all parts of our community, in a way that's respectful and gives them opportunities and the responsibility to be able to take action. And so I actually think that it's a unifying approach as opposed to a divisive approach.
If I could just jump in for a second. I think that the common good is potentially in tension with identity-based politics, and sometimes there are opportunities and sometimes there aren't. And a good example, a concrete one, is affirmative action. The last case I was involved in at the Supreme Court was the Grutter case on affirmative action at the University of Michigan. Now, there are two ways to really defend what University of Michigan was doing. One is to say, well, these students have the right to be at the university. They've been discriminated against, and so on. It's about their rights. The other way, which ultimately persuaded the Supreme Court, was to say, it's about everyone's rights. It's about the diversity and the education of all citizens and learning from your fellow students and making sure they think differently and come at things differently than you, which is what affirmative action in education does. That rationale will work there. It's not going to work so well in other settings like affirmative action and contracts, in which some of that is going to, you know, big bigwig corporations and things like that, which are just creating front persons and claiming a diversity rationale or something like that. So ultimately, there's going to be some tension, but there's a lot of opportunity, I think, when we talk about the common good and how it benefits multicultural pluralism, or however you want to phrase it.
Bruce, you've been involved in every bruising, difficult fight in the Democratic Party, and you get away with a lot because you have a great sense of humor and a great smile. But what, this is, implicit in what in the question Mike raised is an explanation for an awful lot of battles that have taken place on the progressive side inside Democratic politics. Could you talk about that? Well, and I'm trying to get you to start a bruising, difficult fight here on this panel.
I agree with Michael and Neil. I think there is a tension here. And in fact, the last quarter century of modernizing liberalism has been an effort to focus on national interests, not simply narrow interests. I think there is a way to square the circle, which Neil alluded to, which is that the most important right is to individual opportunity, not to a particular outcome. And that is something that all Americans can see as in the common good. I think that if the common good is some kind of guilt trip that sounds charity that sounds like you're going to be the one giving and others are going to be the ones getting, then good luck selling that to the country. As you know, I come from Idaho, which is kind of the Lake Wobegon of American politics, where all the men are strong, the women are good-looking, and the politicians are below average.
Except his mom.
Thank you. But
his mom was in the state Senate.
Yeah, she was the minority leader. There were 31 Republicans and 4 Democrats. E.J. wrote a great book that helped spawn the Georgetown speeches, Why Americans Hate Politics. The central idea that he put forward was that there are a lot of false choices in politics, and I think this is potentially a false choice. But the choice that we need to make is to recognize that we are a country where the common good has been built by the hard work of individuals, and we don't want to make this a choice between conservative individualism and liberal or progressive communitarianism. The essence of America is that a community is built by individuals doing the right things in their own lives.
Jenner Gale, before I ask Professor Kazin to grade the exchange that he encouraged, Jenner Gale, do you want to come in on this?
Yeah. I mean, we see this daily in our work at Faith and Public Life, because what we've been charged with is helping people to build unorthodox and unprecedented coalitions to advance the common good. And no issues divide us more, perhaps, or have been used to divide us more than some of the wedge issues where the rights language is so critical and so important. And maybe it's good, I think that the common good, that sort of framework, helps impose a kind of discipline on our activism that's very practical for us. And a good example of this is when Faith and Public Life was created in December 2004, there were about 40 prominent faith leaders nationally who were brought together to create this effort. And many of them had been active in the feminist movement and the GLBT movement. And many also could not work on those issues or had a different perspective on those issues. So it really brought together a diverse array of leaders. And what all of them decided at that point in time is that we needed to come together on really critical issues of the day, and we needed to also continue to talk about our differences. And so the idea of the common good helped us to work towards some common ground. And we see this daily in our work. In Ohio, for example, we've helped faith leaders there, hundreds of them, interfaith, many different races, many different classes, come together around common ground issues when they've been so divided in the last elections over the gay marriage issues. And in fact, in Northern Ohio, they speak of about 5 wedge issues that are dividing them. But the common good and the common has helped faith leaders find a prophetic common ground that doesn't water down the issues and doesn't sidestep some of the really complicated issues we need to work on together, but it gives us a basis from which to work and a discipline to work out of.
Yeah, this plays out on the international stage as well. And the way it plays out there is this notion that we have a choice between defending at all costs American sovereignty or ceding that sovereignty to the international community in the name of some common good. And I think that the tension you describe is there, but at one level it's a false choice when you look at it internationally. We have this assumption that we can still go by a definition of national security that was defined by Kennan, who said it was the ability of this country to pursue its internal life without serious interference. I don't think we can do that at the family or community level in the United States anymore. We certainly can't do it on the international stage. And if you look at the way globalization has worked, it's transformed the power of the state. It's reduced the power of the state. Our trade today is not between states or national companies. 80% of it is between multinational companies. So I think it is a false choice when you look at it through a global lens, but there still is a very prominent tension that assumes by seeking a larger international common good, we're somehow ceding our domestic sovereignty and we're choosing the firehouses in Baghdad rather than the firehouses at home. So I think we've got some considerable work to do on that front.
Mike, Professor Casey, can you grade this? And in keeping with the common good theory, I'm not going to ask you to give individual grades, but what do you think we have just left out in terms of leaving the hard issues on the table?
Well, one of the hard issues, obviously, is religion, is what kind of Christianity, Judaism, Islam people are talking about when they define the common good. I mean, where the rubber hits the road, I think, right now, are issues of abortion and gay rights, and how do you define those within the common good? I think it can be done. I mean, I think that politicians talk about making abortion rare, but keeping it legal is one way of doing it. I won't mention any names. Who says that? And about gay rights, I think, there's a wonderful verse where Jesus talks about casting the first stone. Those without sin. I think that's one way to deal with the question of gay
rights.
It's an
increasingly relevant passage.
Yeah. exactly. So I think whatever one thinks of gay people getting married, it's that question should come up of humility and versus arrogance about telling people how to live their lives. And I think a community which is united by people respecting one another's choices in that way is one way to understand the common good. Now, I'm a Jew, I'm not a Christian, but I think it's really essential, and one of the reasons I wrote about Brian was I think really essential to think about religious progressivism in a complicated way. Brian was not that complicated progressive, religious progressive, but other people who've been writing now, Barack Obama has some fascinating stuff in his new book about these questions, for example. And I think that for progressives, luckily we no longer, people like me who are basically on the secular side, no longer dismiss religion as a basis for political understanding and expression. But at the same time, I think we have to engage these questions, engage people who take their Bible very seriously and other scriptures very seriously, and find a way to deal with the tensions that I talked about the issues that are the hardest. Because obviously a lot of people are going to say, well, what's the common good about gay rights? A lot of conservatives would say that. It's either you think it's a sin or you don't. This is not a question of finding common ground. But of course, luckily, we all live in a more complicated society than that.
I want to pick up on that and throw this to anybody. A lot of people who are, well, specifically I want to talk about conversations I have with conservative Catholic friends. And, a liberal Catholic is inclined to say, you conservatives are a bunch of hypocrites on poverty. You cut all those phrases from Jesus out of the Bible and so on. And that's, I think, a perfectly serviceable, even true argument of some conservatives. But conservatives who take those passages seriously would throw it back to individualistic liberals and say, yeah, but you guys don't take seriously the ways in which the common good is implicated in our rules about marriage or family life or abortion. What does one say back in that argument? Because I do think there is a kind of communitarian conservative who really does struggle for his or her own notion of the common good. What is, maybe I should ask Reverend Jen, since she is probably involved in these things a lot.
Yeah, we have these conversations a lot. And, you know, I think on the abortion question that's been mentioned, that there is a lot of common ground there in terms of wanting to reduce numbers of abortions and wanting to protect women's health as well, and protecting safe motherhood and those kinds of concepts. So there's a lot of common ground that's been broken there that I think needs to be authentically and sincerely explored. And we continue to host forums where we can have those kinds of conversations among key leadership. On gay marriage, we had an interesting transaction in Cleveland where we pulled together 40 interfaith leaders who hadn't worked together in a decade because they'd been splintered over about 5 wedge issues. And the main issue, you know, they decided where their common ground was, and then they decided to tackle one of these really difficult wedge issues. And they took on the issue of gay marriage, which had really divided them in 2004. And what they realized was they could all stand against bigotry and the use of this as a wedge issue to divide their communities and to distract from the core issues of the day. And when they were able to decide on several talking points around that issue, and this was a very diverse group of people, very splintered, it was like a wind rushed through that room, and they were completely energized and able to move forward and score some victories in subsequent weeks on the issues that they wanted to work on together. So I think it is possible on a very practical level to have these tough conversations, not let loose the difficult issues, but move ahead and work where we can together.
Tom? I think the immigration debate is a very interesting debate to talk about this issue. You look at, Sam Brownback, for instance, Arlen Specter, Ted Kennedy. You're not very often that you're going to get the three of them together on an issue. And I remember going to the rallies on Capitol Hill, and you see so many people in the faith community, Cardinal Mahoney from Los Angeles, coming together. And I really do believe that that is a really good example of how people who have been at loggerheads over gay rights, gay marriage, abortion rights, were able to find common ground around a simple proposition, which is that love thy neighbor as thyself. As I read it in the Bible, I've been looking for footnotes that say, except if you're...